From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Last week, an Apple employee inadvertently left a prototype next-generation iPhone on a bar stool. Oops. Another patron, who later came forward, found it and then sold it for $5,000 to the tech blog Gizmodo, which then published a detailed dissection of the phone, which is due out this summer. Sounds like a walks-in-the-bar joke, but Apple wasn't laughing, and nor were the cops. On Monday, California's Rapid Enforcement Allied Computer Team broke down the door of Gizmodo blogger Jason Chen and seized his computers. Gizmodo, in turn, invoked California's Shield Law for journalists. Shield laws, which vary from state to state, are designed to protect whistleblowers by allowing reporters to withhold the identities of their sources. When Gizmodo invoked the Shield Law, the San Mateo district attorney, who had ordered the seizure, put the search of the computers on hold. Meanwhile, back east, New York Times reporter James Risen was issued a federal grand jury subpoena to reveal sources for his book about the CIA. Should a tech blogger and a national security correspondent be equally deserving of Shield Law protections? George Washington University Law School professor Jonathan Turley says, maybe not. In these two cases.
For many years, there's been an acceptance that there's some limitation to Shield laws. You can't possibly claim that no matter what a journalist does, he can't be forced to produce evidence. That would allow journalists to become the world's most successful bank robbers. So there's always been an exception with regard to criminal acts that were committed or participated in by reporters. Now, this obviously is a very difficult area because whistleblowing often involves the technical violation of federal laws. And the concern is that as we broaden the definition of who is a journalist, it's going to gradually reduce the protection of journalists.
Gizmodo's journalism is all about getting the latest in technology. And the fact that it's narrow in scope, does that make it fundamentally less journalistic an enterprise than trying to find out the excesses of the CIA?
I think what makes it fundamentally less compelling is the fact that they paid for this phone. If they had simply discovered this phone and took pictures of it, no one would question that that's a valid journalistic enterprise. But what they're doing here puts them a hair's breadth away from what a fence does. There has to be some limitations. And the media has been very, very careful in that regard, not to abuse its powers. And in return, they hope to get protections through privilege. Gizmodo, I think, did abuse those powers and may lose privileges for all reporters.
There's still the fact that the police came up with a search warrant and raided the guy's apartment. Everything about this search looks like they were after the journalism and not the provenance of the stolen goods. Shouldn't journalists everywhere be concerned when prosecutors break down doors, not to retrieve stolen property, but to get to the bottom of leaked news?
I think that the prosecutor should have shown more restraint, ironically, in the same fashion that Gizmodo should have shown more restraint. I mean, this is not a mob case. You don't have Chen saying, leave the iPhone, take the cannoli. This is a situation of bad judgment. My biggest concern is that the standards of Gizmodo are going to end up limiting people like Risen.
So let's finally get to James Risen. He was subpoenaed to reveal sources for his book, State of War, The Secret History of the CIA and the Bush Administration. In particular, a chapter about CIA's efforts to disrupt Iranian nuclear weapons research. Now, this investigation began in the Bush administration. Are you surprised that Attorney General Eric Holder has decided to flout the president's expressed support for Shield laws?
Unfortunately, it's not surprising. The Obama administration has not only adopted most of the national security positions of the Bush administration, but has gone beyond it. That has surprised and disappointed many civil libertarians, myself included. What happened during the Bush administration is that both Democrats and Republicans acquiesced to a range of acts that included alleged war crimes. They only became public because of people like Risen. And now you've got the Obama administration taking a course that could very well lead to his being held in contempt and put into jail. the national security people around Obama take a very harsh view, particularly towards journalists. They just don't see the value of what journalists do. That, frankly, is a sign of tremendous ignorance about what this country is about. I mean, it certainly ignores the incredible role that journalists have played in revealing corruption and abuses in the past.
So to bring this full circle, Jonathan, going back to the Gizmodo case, what could happen in that case legally that ultimately could be a threat to James Risen and other journalists who are working on stories where the stakes are a lot higher than the latest 4G phone?
Gizmodo's lawyers will challenge, as they have already publicly, the basis of the search here, and to say that the prosecutors had no right to search the home or the offices of Chen or Gizmodo. That will force the court to determine whether there is an exception under the Shield Law and under federal law when a reporter is involved in an alleged criminal act. It is going to be difficult for a court to simply say that a reporter can never be the subject of a search warrant, even when police are alleging that they have received stolen property. Then you could have every fence in the country declare that they're a blogger. That is why prosecutors prefer to talk about a Jason Chen rather than a James Risen, because the case is simply more compelling in terms of the criminal exception in these laws.
Jonathan, as always, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, Bob.
Jonathan Turley is a professor of law at George Washington University Law School.
On Tuesday, executives from Goldman Sachs confronted a gang of angry senators. Lawmakers interrogated the execs for 10 televised hours about whether their firm had made bets against the collapsing mortgage industry while simultaneously convincing their clients to keep investing in it. The truth of whether they swindled their clients or just hedged their bets will take time and expertise to unearth. The Securities and Exchange Commission investigation is currently underway, which makes Tuesday's hearing a curious affair. Was it a teachable moment for viewers or mere theater? Megan McArdle is the business and economics editor for The Atlantic magazine. She blogged about the hearing at theatlantic.com. Megan, welcome to On the Media.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, did the senators' questions elicit any new information?
Not really. Mostly, this is an opportunity for senators to look very angry at bankers, which is something that they need going into the election. Carl Levin's eyes practically popped out of his head more than once as he yelled at the bankers and told them that they were bad people. And the bankers sat there and took it, mostly for their own theater. They want the public to think they've been chastened.
Senator Levin definitely got most of the headlines for one clip that we've pulled. He's berating a Goldman employee about an email where he described the mortgage deals as excremental.
Look what your sales team was saying about Timberwolf. Boy, that Timberwolf was one deal.
This was an email to me in late June.
Right. You sold Timberwolf after as well.
We did trades after that.
Yeah, okay. It's and the trades after.
Some you, context
yeah.
might be helpful.
The context, let me tell you, the context is mighty clear.
Carl Levin has found an incredibly incriminating quote. So what the guy he was questioning was arguing was, I don't know whether truthfully or not, they had sold it after the date of the email. They had probably sold it at a discount. So a deal that's a bad deal can still be sold. Take Greek debt. Greek debt is not a good investment. You might even say it's excremental. But if I could buy Greek debt for 10 cents on every dollar of face value of that debt, that would probably be a good investment because at some point Greece is going to make good on at least some of the debt and I will get more than my money back.
If you didn't learn anything about the actual substance of the matter, did you learn anything about the Goldman execs?
What I learned about the Goldman execs is that they are still extremely bad at managing their public image. They would get involved in lengthy arguments that just made them look like they were dodging the question.
You actually believe that most people would be better off just not watching these hearings?
I think so. For the people in the financial press, and to a lesser extent, the people in the political press, it's useful to watch these things because you can kind of see what the players are doing, how they're positioning themselves for their next move. But it doesn't actually pull out that much new information. And when there is information given, it's actually pretty hard to follow because there's no one there explaining what a short sale is, what a long position is, what a synthetic CDO is. And if you don't already know those terms pretty well, then you're basically just going to be left to choose sides based on who seems more personable in front of the camera. And I have to say, after watching this for 10 hours, I would have to say none of them.
Well, let's talk about the theater then. Isn't there a role for that in politics? Did it give a viewer a measure of satisfaction just to see these guys squirm?
Absolutely. But that said, I think it's kind of dangerous in two ways. First of all, because it gives people the illusion of understanding what happened. Because the senators control the questioning, they can craft a sort of narrative that doesn't really have much to do with figuring out what went wrong and has a lot to do with what the senator would like to see playing on his or her local news. They'd probably get more answers if they weren't putting these guys in front of the camera.
If not these hearings, then what? I mean, people care about this. You know, during the Watergate hearings, there was, a great deal of theater.
But in the Watergate hearings, there were matters of fact that were comprehensible to the general public, which these issues just aren't. It gives people, as I say, the illusion that they understand what's going on, and it gives them a certain amount of schadenfreude. But I think that there are other ways that that could be achieved. For example, by actually passing some financial regulation. And it's not clear to me whether having gotten on television yelling at Goldman bankers doesn't make people a little less interested in doing financial reform, right? Because now they don't have to in order to get reelected. They've gotten themselves out there as on record as being really, really mean to bankers.
The theater could be a substitute for action.
Exactly.
Megan, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Megan McArdle is the business and economics editor for The Atlantic Magazine.
Coming up, the war that comes in ones and zeros and what to do about it.
This is On the Media from NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. In February of 2010, the U.S. Joint Forces Command issued a report that looked at the threat confronting us in cyberspace. It concluded, quote, "Through cyberspace, enemies will target industry, academia, government, as well as the military in the air, land, maritime, and space domains. In much the same way that air power transformed the battlefield of World War II, cyberspace has fractured the physical barriers that shield a nation from attacks on its commerce and communication." This was hardly news to Richard Clark. Clark is an intelligence and counterterrorism expert who served in the administrations of Presidents Reagan, W.H. Bush, Clinton, and W. Bush. He's the co-author of a new book, Cyber War: The Next Threat to National Security and What to Do About It. It offers a scarifying cyber doomsday scenario, but it's also full of stories from the annals of real-life cyber attacks. Clark writes that the British government had already alerted 300 of its largest companies that their computer networks had likely been hacked and their industrial secrets stolen by the Chinese. Last year, the U.S. Defense Department created an official cyber command that should be operational in 2010, but Clark doesn't think the U.S. is any more secure.
The head of the CIA, the head of National Intelligence, the head of the U.S. military have all said that they believe China has penetrated most American companies. The truth is, it's likely that every major U.S. corporation, every research lab, and most government agencies have been successfully penetrated by China, and terabytes, whole libraries of Congress, have been exfiltrated. We know it happened at the Advanced Physics Lab at Johns Hopkins University last summer, which has government contracts to work on cybersecurity, and they couldn't stop it. They watched the data go out the door.
It seems to harken back to the days of the Cold War. In cyberspace, China and Russia are again America's biggest adversaries.
Well, that's right, but there are between 20 and 30 nations, according to a CIA witness before the Congress, that have cyber war capability. And we've seen small countries like North Korea and Taiwan and Israel all have pretty good capability. North Korea is a very interesting case because it has no cyberspace to speak of its own. So they deploy their attackers outside of the country. They deploy them in South Korea, they deploy them in China, and they have been experimenting with attacks on the United States. On July 4th, 2009, they staged the largest denial of service attack seen in history so far, which means that they flooded a variety of sites in Washington.
Such as?
The White House, the Department of Homeland Security, oddly, the Washington Post, and a few others.
What about stateless groups like Al-Qaeda? Do they pose a significant threat in this space?
We have not yet seen evidence that Al-Qaeda or Hezbollah, Hamas, and the others are actually using cyber war techniques. What we've seen is that they are using it the way Harvard uses it, to fundraise, to do outreach.
Getting back to the big guns, I was intrigued by a Chinese maneuver that you describe early in the book involving Cisco routers. Is there a short way to tell that story?
Well, we have stories about Chinese companies copying the American router Cisco produces that's on all networks. And in one case, they sold it under the label Cisco. It was a counterfeit. The Defense Department and the National Security Agency have reason to believe that these Cisco routers may have been compromised by the Chinese government, which means that they would see all the traffic from a network like perhaps the Pentagon. And it was Pentagon components that bought the counterfeit routers.
But you say Russia is even better armed in cyberspace than China.
They have a very extensive bureaucracy dedicated to cyber war and cyber espionage. And they have a very good research base. They've been doing it in a way that doesn't get noticed. China gets a lot of press by attacking Google and other people, but Russia does it and doesn't break the door down on its way in and doesn't leave breadcrumbs back to the Kremlin on its way out.
For decades, when we were faced with a nuclear threat, America and Russia used deterrence, mutually assured destruction, to keep either nation from pushing the nuclear button. Can't a strategy like that work in cyberspace?
Deterrence is based on a fear of a demonstrated capability, and we have never seen that demonstrated capability. In the nuclear scenarios, there were over 2,000 nuclear weapons exploded in the atmosphere by the United States and the United Kingdom, France, and Russia to demonstrate what nuclear weapons could do. No one's ever seen a big cyber war. We've seen some small ones, some primitive ones. Moreover, it assumes that you know who's attacking you. In nuclear war, you saw the bombers coming, you saw the missiles coming, in theory, and you could tell where they were coming from. In cyberspace, it's not always clear who the attacker is, but it appears to be the Pentagon's doctrine and the Obama administration's doctrine that they will anticipate the attack coming, and they will then use cyber war to take out the systems of the attacker. Now, there are lots of problems with that strategy. It requires us to respond very quickly when we might not really know the identity of the attacker. And it assumes the attack is going to come from outside our country, when it would be very easy for an attacker to come into the United States and seize computers even remotely. The attack, for example, that Russia did on the nation of Georgia was from a computer in Brooklyn.
What sort of safeguards does the government employ right now? I mean, how much does our cybersecurity suffer from the kind of turf wars between agencies that roadblocked vital information before 9/11?
Well, there's a very similar situation right now. The government says this new cyber command, a military organization, will defend the Pentagon, and the Department of Homeland Security will defend the rest of the government, even though they admit they can't do that yet. But then they say, everybody else, you're on your own. We suggest in the book that this is a bit akin to if in the Cold War the government had said to people like U.S. Steel in Pittsburgh, hey, the Russians have a lot of bombers and they may come over and bomb Pittsburgh. You, U.S. Steel, should go out and buy an air defense network.
So what do you suggest?
What we suggest is a defensive strategy. You pick two or three things which really matter and which a lot of other things are dependent upon. So number one, do everything you can to make it impossible to attack the electric power grid. Number two, the big internet service providers, on which 80 or 90% of the traffic move, have those internet service providers scanning, not the content of our emails, but scanning to see patterns of attack malware. The technology exists to do that. So they could be looking for attacks, and they could be killing attacks before they got to the targets.
A critical review of your book in Wired magazine suggested that that's a slippery slope. Who's to say that unwelcome speech won't also be intercepted?
Well, I reject slippery slope arguments because they're always arguments for not doing something because of something you're not proposing. What we're suggesting is not that the government look at what's going across the networks, but that the big ISPs, Internet Service Providers, scan not the content of what's going across the networks, but the ones and zeros to see if they can recognize attack software. There's no infringement on privacy, and in fact, what we propose is that there be an outside privacy watchdog organization to prevent any abuses. And the third thing we suggest is that we do more of what we're doing now, which is to try to make the Pentagon systems more invulnerable. And we have to supplement it with international agreements and potentially arms control. So far, we have arms control for biological war and chemical war and nuclear war, but not yet for cyber war.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Richard Clark is the co-author with Robert Naik of Cyber War, The Next Threat to National Security and What to Do About It.
North Korea generates endless headlines with its cyber attacks, erratic displays of nuclear capability, suspected attacks on South Korean shipping, and speculation about who will succeed the ailing dear leader. It also grabs attention as an isolated and seemingly Stalinist dictatorship with a yearning to be a force on the world stage. But few countries are as watched and yet as little understood as North Korea. B.R. Myers believes that he's solved at least some of the mystery. He's a South Korean academic who has focused on North Korea's internal and external propaganda, and he's written a study of what he believes is the North Koreans' worldview. It's called The Cleanest Race, How North Koreans See Themselves and Why It Matters. Myers says our only chance of deciphering North Korea's behavior is to understand how its government controls the message, starting with the actual pamphlets that message is printed on.
The paper on which North Korean propaganda is produced is very poor quality, rough. You really can't bend it back and forth more than a few times without it crumbling in your hands. And the TV news, for example, does not show sound. I mean, they have a news announcer who's talking over news clips, but you don't actually get any sound from the news clips themselves. And literally every interview is staged. So if they go up to somebody on the street and put a microphone in their face, you can see them reading off from the cue cards. It's almost comical.
So 100% of news and information that every North Korean encounters is manufactured by the government.
That's right. And it's different from the old Soviet Union or even from Mao's China in the sense that you don't have an underground press. I've talked to several refugees, including the small number of refugees that you can consider real dissidents. And even they say there's none of that sort of activity going on.
I want to ask you about the myths that have evolved about North Korea, starting with the notion that it is an ultra-Marxist state, monumentally failed, but also somehow pure in its communist ideology and infrastructure. You say not really.
Yeah, and the North Koreans have actually made my case very easy for me by deleting all mention of the word communism from their constitution. I think this myth, of course, goes back to the very important fact that the Soviet Union installed this regime into power in 1945. But I think it also has a lot to do with the fact that North Korea has a command economy, a centralized economy. Now, we tend to think that only a communist would be crazy enough to want a command economy, but we don't realize Imperial Japan, Nazi Germany, actually all those fascist states wanted that kind of an economy, but politically they were incapable of implementing it. North Korea is ideologically about as far away from communism as you could be.
You talk about, in your book, two versions of North Korean propaganda, one for domestic consumption and one strictly for the outside world. Let's start with the latter. It's a sort of ideological sounding mishmash called Juche thought. What is Juche thought?
Well, Juche thought emerged actually as a result of the Cultural Revolution in China. In the mid-1960s, Mao Zedong came to be celebrated not just in China, but actually around the world as a great and original thinker. And the North Koreans, being right next door to China, felt threatened by this. They were worried that their own people might become infected by this Maoist ideology. So they decided to concoct something that they called Juche thought. But in fact, this ideology is nothing but a collection of humanist clichés. For example, man is the master of all things, or all people are born with creativity. It really is just a series of inconsecutive assertions. It's a decoy. It decoys the world away from North Korea's true ideology, which is something very different.
Decoys. So we know that Yasser Arafat, for example, used to say one thing in English to sound temperate and approachable to the West, and then quite something else to his Arabic-speaking audiences. Now, North Korea, when it does speak to the outside world, it's not engaged necessarily in Arafatian soft peddling, right?
It does try to convey the impression to the outside world that North Korea is just a beleaguered, misunderstood, isolated country that desperately wants to become part of the international community, but is blocked by the United States. Whereas they tell their own people that North Korea can basically do whatever it wants around the world, that the rest of the world is afraid of North Korea.
We're speaking of a population that is living in grinding poverty and with zero political freedom. Yet you see not much evidence of pushback against the regime, which suggests that the propaganda that you've described actually strikes a chord with the people. Not that they've been brainwashed, but that it conforms with their worldview.
Right. Well, you know, nationalism or racism, and when you're dealing with a nation state, nationalism really is basically racism, is it hugely appealing to believe that you are part of a uniquely good in-group and that everybody in the out-group is inferior to you. And another advantage of nationalism is that it works just as well in bad economic times as in good ones. When things go well, it's because you're such a great race. And when things go badly, it's because the outside world is out to get you. And I think this explains why this system has survived so much longer than Marxism-Leninism did. Communism basically promised everybody a better life, and when it failed to deliver on that, the game was over.
An interesting aspect of the North Korean government's message to its people is its surprising insistence on telling the truth, or at least a kind of truth. You write that China, for example, under Mao, or Russia under Stalin, told people that the harvests had been wildly successful, even as people were starving. North Korea doesn't try to hide the fact that it is economically vastly below South Korea, for example.
Well, it didn't hide that fact for a long time. During the 1990s, when the famine was in full swing, the regime did admit to serious economic difficulties. This is starting to change now. I believe it's because the North Korean people are so aware now of South Korea's material superiority, and they're also aware that the South Korean people are perfectly happy living under the Yankee boot heel, as the North Koreans would put it. And I think this is placed the North Korean regime under pressure to promise that material conditions are going to improve drastically in the next 2 or 3 years. And this is a new tone in North Korean propaganda. They really are claiming, in effect, that by the year 2012, which will be the 100th anniversary of Kim Il-sung's birth, North Korea will effectively be just as economically powerful as South Korea.
How very Herbert Hoover. Your prosperity is just around the corner.
Yeah, and it's a very dangerous thing to do. And it worries me because I believe that when this propaganda campaign falls on its face, it's not a question of if, the regime is going to feel, I think, a certain pressure to divert the attention of the masses elsewhere. And this is where I think we see a higher potential for some kind of diversionary war or conflict on the peninsula in the next 3 years. I think we should beware of overestimating people's readiness to abandon this system. It's not going to be as easy as simply dropping leaflets into North Korea and everybody suddenly seeing the truth. I think we need to remember that people are psychologically invested in this system. If you are 50 or 60 years old in North Korea, you don't want to wake up one day and find out that you've spent your life basically working for one man in Pyongyang. You want to believe that you are part of this sacred racial mission to rout the Yankees from the peninsula and to unite the motherland.
You know, it occurs to me that while they may lack food, resources, any kind of hope for the future, at least they have something that a lot of people in the West don't have. Right or wrong, they have a sense of the meaning of life.
Exactly. And that really is the heart of the matter. I mean, social psychologists like Ernest Becker have said that all culture really is an effort to give significance to our lives. And I live in South Korea, where the orthodox ideology really is consumerism, where everybody is led to believe that by amassing as much money and consumer goods as possible, they give their lives meaning. And that ideology really excludes about 90% of the people from success, which is why I think in South Korea you have one of the highest suicide rates in the world. And it's kind of ironic that in North Korea, where the standard of living is so much lower, people do seem to feel more of a sense of belonging to the community. And maybe this is one of the reasons why we haven't seen emigration or escape from North Korea in anything like the numbers that you would expect from a ruined economy.
Brian, thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
B.R. Myers directs the International Studies Department at Donsau University in South Korea and is author of The Cleanest Race, How North Koreans See Themselves and Why It Matters.
Coming up, some worry that the internet will fragment us, but soon it may create the ultimate unifying device, a universal translator.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day, at wallacefoundation.org. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide at fordfoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone with some of your letters, comments, and tweets. My interview with New York University professor Clay Shirky 2 weeks ago caused quite a stir. I asked Shirky why he thinks media outlets, including NPR, feature so few female commentators and sources in their stories. Shirky says it's an extension of a problem he sees among his graduate students at NYU. He said, quote, "Not enough women have what it takes to behave like arrogant, self-aggrandizing jerks."
This story blamed women for sexism, responded Rebecca from New York City. Quote, "There are lots of reasons why women may not put themselves out there more, including that it's seen as inappropriate and they are punished for it." Mac from Pennsylvania agreed. Quote, "The story seemed to conclude that it was the fault of women for not asserting themselves enough to catch the attention of journalists. Good journalists would find the best sources, male or female, self-promoting or not." And Chris wrote simply, "Perhaps men should be pressured to stop being arrogant, overconfident jerks instead of pressuring women to be like men."
But many of you told us that Shirky was right on the money. Jileen from Lynn, Massachusetts wrote, "As a woman who has had to learn the hard way to put myself forward just to survive, I actually thought your rant was correct and moderate." Galen from New York chimed in, "I couldn't agree more with Shirky. If I hear one more speech of men receiving awards thanking their wives for being there while they were doing the difficult work, I will throw up."
Please keep all of your feedback coming to us in all its various forms. To send an email, go to our site onthemedia.org and click on Contact Us. You can also post comments there, or you can follow us on Twitter at @on_the_media.
English may be the internet's dominant language, but it's employed by only 27% of internet users. Chinese seems certain to surpass it within a few years, and dozens of other languages are experiencing huge growth. Will vast swaths of cyberspace be lost to us, blocked by an insurmountable language barrier? OTM's Mark Phillips set out to explore whether the net is developing any new tools to fix a very old communication problem.
Every once in a while, I stumble onto a web page that isn't in English. My immediate reaction is, oh, this is wrong, and I hit the back button as fast as I can. I know this is proof of some sort of Amero-Anglo hegemonic bias or something, but let's face it, we English speakers have gotten used to thinking this way.
There's been this sense that English is the default language on the internet.
Ethan Zuckerman, co-founder of the multilingual blog network Global Voices, says this is because the internet started as a project by the U.S. military and then grew with the help of American universities. Zuckerman says at first the ingrained English bias had a big upside.
Things were easier. It was easier to have the sense that we were all in the same conversation, that we were all laughing at the same jokes. There's something great about a common language. A common language is a first step towards communication across cultural boundaries.
Well, we've been here before.
David Bellos is the director of the Program in Translation and Intercultural Communication at Princeton University.
From about the 4th century AD until the age of Newton and Leibniz and Spinoza, there was Latin, and it was very convenient. Nobody grew up speaking Latin. Latin was a learned language, but it was the language of philosophy, religion, law, debate, science, for more than 1,000 years throughout the whole of Europe. And it was wonderful, very convenient. And right now, there are far more users of English as a foreign language than there are speakers of English as a native language. English is, in that sense, the new Latin.
But Ethan Zuckerman has noticed big changes in just the past few years. Back in 2004, he was at a dinner in Amman, Jordan, with about 20 bloggers who were chatting away in Arabic.
But almost all of them were blogging in English at that point. I pulled aside my friend Ahmed Humaid and said, "Why is it that you guys write in English? You're all more comfortable in Arabic." And Ahmed said, "Look, if we want the rest of the world to listen to us, we've got to speak in English because they don't speak Arabic." Out of that group of people that I had dinner with, a lot of those people blog in Arabic now. And I've gone back and I've talked to some of them and said, "Well, what made you switch?" And what one said to me was, "Now our friends, our peers, our neighbors, they're all online. That's who we want to reach."
In the Renaissance, people moved away from Latin and began writing and printing in the local vernaculars. And that helped produce, well, a Renaissance. Same goes for the web now.
It has allowed billions of people to come onto this network. It's really hard to imagine 400 million Chinese users coming onto the internet if English was a precursor for them into participating in this space.
Non-English growth is skyrocketing. Arabic internet users, for example, have increased by over 2,000% over the past decade.
The one big negative is that it introduces this huge source of fragmentation. Lots of separate internets. And they're separated by a couple of different things. But language is the big one. And language is the one that turns out to be hardest to overcome.
One dream is that translation software could make all the content on the web available to everyone, no matter what language it's in. A popular science article from April 1958 shows just how old this vision is. Of course, they didn't have the internet back then, but the article explains...
"Each year, millions of reports on scientific research are published, a big fraction of them in foreign languages. In this mass of Russian, Dutch, Chinese, and Hindustani data are clues to H-power, interplanetary flight, more powerful batteries, longer-wearing tires. What we need is a machine to read one language and type in another. An automatic translator."
The history of machine translation really begins during the Second World War when, in the UK and especially at Bletchley Park, enemy codes were cracked.
Princeton professor David Bellos.
After the war, just as computers were being invented, the bright idea came that maybe you could use these wonderful new machines to do code cracking and that maybe languages could be looked at as if they were in code, as if the real meaning of the thing was actually the English and the Russian was just, you know, one of these complicated ways of masking what the real meaning was.
First, you teach the computer vocabulary. Apple equals yablaka. Then you teach it all the rules and grammar, do it for every language, and boom, you've got a Star Trek-style universal translator.
It didn't produce the results they wanted.
David Bellos.
The reason it didn't was that it was based on a not very sophisticated idea of what language actually is. What I'm saying isn't in code for something else. It is what I'm saying. So there are really very strict limits on what you can do with machine translation based on the idea of code. By the early 1960s, they'd pretty much given up.
This rules-based machine translation was a failure, but there was still another method called statistical translation. Think of it as a behavioral approach. The underlying grammar and syntax don't matter, but repeated exposure to language as it's actually used does. It's like how babies learn. You don't diagram sentences for them. They just hear you say stuff and copy you. The catch is, to teach the machine, you have to load huge amounts of text into the computer. Back in the 1960s, they didn't have enough data to make a statistical machine translation work. Now we do, says Michael Galvez, a project manager at Google Translate.
What we do is we actually use hundreds of billions of words that Google infrastructure has access to.
It's a two-step process. First, Google's computers pull it all in, recognize the language, and create what they call a language model. There's one for each of the 52 languages currently on the service. As they get more data for a particular language, the computers get a better feel for it. It knows from a statistical standpoint that in English, the sentence, "the boy are sad," is very rare, just as a five-year-old knows that sounds weird. But the language model only teaches the computer how to speak each language by itself. The next step is to learn how to go between multiple languages. Google's Michael Galvez says for that,
we also build what's called a translation model using previous human translation that we have access to, documents from the EU, the United Nations, very high quality translation corpora.
Everything spoken or written at the United Nations is automatically translated into six languages. Google uses UN and European Union transcripts along with tons of other professional, high-quality translations to build this translation model, which allows their computers to take a sentence and predict what it would be in another language. Michael Galvez.
We take the language model and the translation model, and we put these two models together, and we basically create the machine translation system out of this.
It produces startlingly accurate results. Plug in an article from a Spanish language newspaper, and it reads like an English article that just needs a trip to the copy editor. And the original text doesn't have to be perfect to get a good translation.
If Google Translate has seen a particular construction many times in the past, then it should be able to translate this correctly. So it can take the wrong word and translate it into the right word in the foreign language. And that's because it sees these mistakes on the web and it basically learns from them.
Galvez had me type a sentence for translation with the word receive spelled incorrectly, with the I before the E, a mistake I usually make. Google's computers ignored my misspelling and translated it into Spanish correctly. And since there's plenty of slang on the web, Google Translate also knows what to do with that. Like the abbreviation for laugh out loud.
I just typed in LOL, and that's ha 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 with a J.
Yes, so we found LOL. Yeah, in Spanish it's ha 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 with a J, yeah.
Google has even integrated Translate into its search engine. Galvez had me enable the translated search feature and type in...
Let's do Belgian waffles.
Belgian waffles.
Okay. Delicious looking.
Google translates Belgian waffles into a bunch of languages, searches, and then shows me the best foreign language sites translated back into English.
Let me see. If you go to the first link, it says Belgian waffles. It's actually translated from French. So if you click on that link, you will actually be able to navigate to the French site, and you're actually experiencing this website now in English. If you click on waffle, it will actually show you the recipes in English.
Wow.
Being able to search and read all French recipes on the web without speaking a word of French is amazing. But Google Translate makes plenty of mistakes. Using the Google Translate app on my phone, I tried to have a conversation with someone who speaks Chinese. I started by asking him a simple question.
Can I ask you a couple questions? This thing doesn't make sense. When you say, can I ask you a couple questions? Couple, I mean, you can translate as the husband and wife. They translate as, can I ask you this couple questions?
Like a husband and wife?
Yes.
Let me try it again without saying a couple. Okay, can I ask you some questions?
Yeah.
That's right?
Yeah. 当然可以的.
What were you trying to say?
I say, of course you can.
The answer was gay.
So far.
The voice recognition was the first problem. It had trouble turning his voice into text. But even when we typed in the text, the translation only gave us the gist of what the other person said. And that might help a tourist find the bathroom, but is it really enough to usher a new era of communication? Would an article translated by a machine be enough to persuade community leaders in Africa to adopt a new way to combat malaria? Also, machine translation takes away the nuance and art of prose. Would an English speaker read an eloquent and satirical Saudi blogger if the translation just barely made sense? Or will we always need a human translator to get the whole picture?
The solution isn't machine translation just getting better or human translators just getting more pervasive. The solution is some combination of the two.
Blogger Ethan Zuckerman.
We're doing a much, much better job of figuring out how to organize these communities of human translators, take advantage of people's willingness to volunteer, willingness to work for small sums of money. I think that translation is going to go from being esoteric, rare, and expensive to becoming fairly commonplace, participatory, and expected.
A new website called Midan.net is an example of this kind of project. It translates stories about the Arab world from both English and Arab media. The short posts on the homepage are always translated by a person.
The idea is a Wikipedia-style approach to translation.
Midan's founder, Ed Bice.
Any registered translator on our system, and we now have about 1,000 people who are capable of generating translations on Midan, can contribute to improving a translation.
Midan doesn't rely solely on people, though. When you comment on a story, it's instantly sent through a machine translator. The result is that everything on the website is in both languages. But where Midan is particularly innovative is how it presents the translations. The traditional way is to put a toggle button at the top of the webpage where you choose your language. Click on English, and all the Arabic on the page disappears. That's how Google Translate works. But Ed Bice says Midan does it differently.
So on Midan, we have side-by-side. Page right is Arabic, which conveniently it's a right-to-left language, and we have page left, English.
Of course, I only read the English column on the left, but if it's a translation, it has a gray background, and I intuitively know it's a translation. A white background lets me know I'm reading a comment originally written in English. Ed Bice says seeing the comments in Arabic, even if you can't understand them, is a potent reminder that you're talking to someone who may have a very different point of view.
We think you need a visual cue, and kind of having that visual cue, you can actually see this cross-language conversation happening on the website.
You immediately see a ping-pong back and forth between the two languages, something you'd lose if there was just one column in your language. On Midan, a two-sentence story about a Syrian man throwing his shoe at the Turkish prime minister generated 26 comments. The first two were originally in English, then two from Arabic, then five that were originally in English, then three from Arabic, and so on. At first, the two languages seem to be having different conversations, but as the thread continues, English speakers begin responding to Arabic comments, and vice versa. It becomes a cross-cultural conversation about the meaning of shoe throwing.
There are two narratives that describe almost any emerging situation or policy decision regarding the U.S. and the Middle East, and the most obvious dividing line for those narratives is linguistic.
So if sites like Midan put these two narratives side by side and translate them, will a third narrative emerge? Will our differences dissolve and world peace reign? Ethan Zuckerman says, not so fast.
When you can read what people say in their own languages, it's often a lot less diplomatic. It's often a lot more nationalistic. They tend to be unaware of the other audiences that might be paying attention. My favorite example of this in many ways is Jack Cafferty of CNN.
We're in hock to the Chinese up to our eyeballs as we continue to import their junk.
Who referred to the Chinese as
basically the same bunch of goons and thugs they've been for the last 50 years.
That comment was widely translated, circulated all throughout the Chinese web, and some Chinese citizens sued CNN for $1 billion, $1 for each offended Chinese person. And while the lawsuit, I don't think, had legal implications, CNN was forced to apologize. Cafferty got on the air and apologized and said, no, I was talking about the government, I wasn't talking about the people. As we get better and better and better at translating, I think what it's really going to do is force us to address each other's preconceptions, prejudices, biases. But unless we can actually hear what people are saying, it's very hard to start in that process.
So it's not just about generating good translations. It's also about being aware of them. Because if we know the rest of the world is listening to us, we'll be more conscious of our casual jabs and unexamined assumptions and begin to hear ourselves as others hear us. And we need to hear them. Remember, 73% of internet users are not using English right now, and that number is growing fast. If we want to access all the internet has to offer, we have to give up the idea that English is the Latin of the digital age. Never again can we count on one language to connect us all. For On the Media, I'm Mark Phillips.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, Nazanin Rafsanjani, and PJ Vogt, with more help from Alex Goldman, Lynn Davis, and Peter Henderson, and edited by Brooke. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Dylan Keefe.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe our executive producer. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.